Welcome to the Yogic Studies Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell. This podcast features in-depth explorations into the traditions of yoga, Sanskrit, Indian philosophy, and South Asian religions. Through candid conversations with scholars and practitioners, we will immerse in the latest and most cutting-edge research on all things yoga. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of the Yogic Studies Podcast. In today's episode, we'll be speaking with Dr. Karen O'Brien Kopp from the University of Roehampton in London about her fascinating work on the intersections between Patanjali Yoga and Buddhist yoga texts and traditions. Dr. Karen O'Brien Kopp is a lecturer in Asian religions and ethics in the Department of Philosophy, Theology, and Religious Studies at the University of Roehampton, London. She received her PhD from SOAS, University of London, and is a specialist in the historical study of meditation and yoga within Asian religious traditions, and in the analysis of early Hindu and Buddhist meditation manuals in Sanskrit. Karen has published peer-reviewed articles in Religions of South Asia and the Journal of Indian Philosophy, and she is a co-editor of the forthcoming book, The Routledge Handbook of Yoga and Meditation Studies, which will come out in fall of 2020. It's an interdisciplinary volume of 34 chapters from global contributors, and which we talk about at the end of this podcast. She is currently working on a new book project on rethinking classical yoga in relation to Buddhism. As you'll hear in this episode, Karen will actually be teaching a new online course for us here at Yogic Studies on this very subject, entitled YS109, Classical Yoga and Buddhism. It's a 4-week online course which begins on July 13th, 2020. This course will offer a unique opportunity for comparative study, to read the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali alongside lesser-known Buddhist texts on yoga and meditation from the same time period. For all course info and registration, you can visit yogicstudies.com/YS-109. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Karen O'Brien Kopp. All right. I'm here with Karen O'Brien Kopp. Is that how you pronounce it?
That is. Thank you.
Good. Karen, thank you so much for being here and joining the Yogic Studies podcast. I'm really happy to have this conversation with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. How's your day going? Are you over in London right now?
I am in London, and it's the hottest day of the year so far. So you may hear the jubilant musical noises of children on the street in the late evening sunshine.
Okay, good to note. And are you just finishing up a term of teaching right now? Are you at the University of Roehampton? Is that right?
I am indeed. I am a lecturer in Asian religions and ethics at the University of Roehampton. And I am, yes, finishing up marking for the spring term and looking ahead to planning for the autumn term.
Yes. And before your autumn term there, of course, you're going to be teaching a course for us here at Yogic Studies.
I am. And I'm very excited about that. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, I'm really excited and thrilled to have you offer this course on classical yoga and Buddhism. And I'm excited to talk with you about those subjects today on this podcast and about your research and your work investigating a really important and interesting topic, I think, for many on this confluence between early so-called classical yoga, and we'll talk about that term and phrase and why we might need to even rethink that a little bit, but the yoga of Patanjali, or Patanjali yoga, and its counterpart and conversation partner and interlocutor with Buddhism. And before we get into those texts and those subjects, though, I wonder if you might give us a little bit of background about yourself and how you became an academic and somebody who studies yoga philosophy, Sanskrit, and Buddhism.
I have been a practitioner of yoga for probably about 25 years. So it was through the practitioner path that I became interested in academic study. I did an MA in traditions of yoga and meditation at SOAS University of London in the Department of Religions and Philosophies, and I studied Sanskrit there. Very fortunate to study with Jim Mallinson at SOAS, who was also on my supervisory committee for my PhD. So I stayed on at SOAS to do a PhD looking at the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali and its connections to Buddhist ideas and practices.
Great. And yeah, your thesis at SOAS is entitled, I love the title of your thesis, Seed and Cloud as Metaphors of Liberation in Buddhist and Patanjali Yoga, an intertextual study. So tell us a little bit in brief about this dissertation, about your work, and why studying the Yoga of Patanjali, why it's so important to read Buddhist texts alongside Patanjali.
When I began to read the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali within a wider corpus of religious and philosophical texts from the early Common Era, I was struck by the scholarship, but also the textual resonances that I was seeing myself between the Yoga Sutra and its commentary and the contemporaneous religious texts and philosophical texts of Buddhism. Mm. So I became interested in the scholarship that already existed, but which seemed to me in part fragmentary in investigating the claims that part of the discourse of the Yoga Sutra might be identified as quote-unquote Buddhist, or perhaps sections of the text were in some way circulating in Buddhist oral or written textual traditions, or that there were certain terms that were perhaps being borrowed or in some kind of conceptual dialogue with Buddhist systems of thought and liberation. So I became interested in the scholarship, which, to be honest, was already long-standing. So these observations had been made for a century of scholarship, you know, starting with Emil Senar in 1900, going through to Delavalle Poussin in the 1930s, whereby scholars were noticing that there was a certain stream of technical language in the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, which seemed to be more coherently identifiable as part of Buddhist discourse. So the scholarship was there. It seemed to me that there were lots of finely tuned analyses looking at particular terms or perhaps particular sutras, at being examined perhaps in chapters or articles. And my attempt was to do something a little bit more systematic. I'd hoped to take a synchronic slice of history. You know, if we approximately date the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, or the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali and its commentary, if we approximately date that to late 4th, early 5th century, then what else was in circulation at the time? Mm-hmm. And it seemed to be necessary to read the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali intertextually in its own textual, conceptual, intellectual practice-based milieu to see what other ideas it might have been interacting with, what other texts it may have been referring to. So that was the broad projection and scope mm-hmm. of the dissertation at the outset. And I was able to begin with some very solid scholarship by people like Philip Maas, who I saw give a paper in 2013 at the University of Vienna on the way in which Patanjali appeared to be responding to a particular set of sutras or a set of verses in Buddhist Abhidharma literature, Sarvastivada Abhidharma, which is a particular school. So I began to look at a particular Buddhist text, which was the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya, we can talk about that, mm-hmm. of Vasubandhu. And the more I looked, the more I found in terms of other Buddhist texts. So actually, I feel that my dissertation, although I wanted to do something more systematic, in a sense, feels like I just opened the door into, you know, a whole project where there's still a great deal of scholarship to be done. Mm-hmm. Because it's an intertextual endeavor, as I said, the more you look, the more you find that's interesting and needs to be investigated further from text to text.
Right. So you note that there is a longstanding history of scholars raising these questions and issues, pointing to shared terminology between yoga and Buddhist texts going back, you know, at least 100 years. But it also, in my experience, has been the case that while you have very in-depth studies on the Buddhist side, sort of on the, you know, the Buddhologists, say Yogacara or Abhidharma texts, and then as yoga studies has really continued to grow, especially in recent decades, kind of on the side of yoga history and yoga philosophy, the philology and study of yoga's texts, sometimes those fields can sort of seem far apart or not always in conversation, especially at conferences like the American Academy of Religion, where you have the, you know, the Yogacara specialists and, you know, an entire working group dedicated to that. But there often is not much dialogue and exchange between the Yogacara Buddhist scholars and the yoga studies scholars. So I think what you're doing in some ways is helping to bridge that gap and is really important in bringing these two fields of scholarship together to read across these texts, which, as your work shows, really does need to be read together, because it seems, and we'll talk about this more with some examples, how the authors of these texts themselves seem to have been in conversation. Do you have any thoughts about that? Or, you know, how do you agree with that assessment that at oftentimes, and I'm sure there's many exceptions to this, but oftentimes that there's kind of the Buddhist scholars over here and the yoga scholars over here and not always in conversation?
I do agree. And I think there are, of course, also important exceptions. So if you look at the work of Gerald Larson, for example, who was a foremost scholar of classical Sankhya, he very much investigated the Buddhist texts and the Buddhist traditions. And I think when we look at the work of some South Asian scholars like Pradeep Gokhale, they have for many years been making this argument that, you know, the Patanjali Yoga Shastra is interwoven with certain Buddhist texts and traditions. But I think on the whole, you make a really important point, which is that we do have this categorical separation that is very much bound up with the, in a sense, the scholarly evolution of the category of religion itself in the 19th century and the whole development of the world religions paradigm, and the way in which Hinduism gets distinguished from, you know, another discrete entity, categorical entity called Buddhism, distinguished from another discrete entity called Jainism in the history of early South Asia. So in some senses, this is a Eurocentric categorical lens that I would say is bound up with the project of empire, with the colonialist project. It's part of the, you know, the 19th century administrative enterprise of categorizing and sorting South Asian culture so that it can be better, quote unquote, managed as a resource. So I think epistemically, our present day universities are still working within that framework to a certain degree. And that means when you quite often, when you go to study, for example, South Asian religions, you will end up being a specialist in either Hindu studies or Buddhist studies, but not necessarily both, or perhaps Jain studies, or perhaps South Asian Islam. So on the one hand, we have that history of the way religions have been categorized and studied in academia. But on the other hand, there are also very good reasons why scholars tend to specialize in either Buddhism or, for example, Hinduism, which have to do quite often with the amount of time and skill that is invested in language expertise. So I have invested my time in Prakrit and Sanskrit, which have also given me access to particular texts in the Indian Buddhist tradition. However, you get to a certain point with Buddhist studies and you realize, oh, actually, to access these texts, which are extant only in Chinese or Tibetan, I really need to have Chinese and Tibetan.
Right.
So I think there are, you know, different language skill sets that scholars tend to acquire at the outset if they're going to go into Buddhist studies. And quite often, because of the way, the ways in which Buddhism transmitted very quickly regionally across Asia, you do need to have more than Sanskrit. You need to have Chinese and or Tibetan as well.
Yeah.
And possibly some Central Asian languages. So I think, you know,
it becomes a huge undertaking that then takes the graduate student in all kinds of directions.
Right. And it might be a decision that you need to make fairly early on in your career, perhaps in terms of that language acquisition and which languages you get in your toolbox early on. And which scripts as well. So, I mean, I think in some senses it's, you know, that's one very understandable reason why we do have these streams of scholarship. Partly the ways in which academia operates, and I think partly it's just very practically the way that particular disciplinary scholarly paths develop quite early on in a career.
And yet, if we are to understand a text like the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, as your work so clearly demonstrates, we really are to think not just intertextually, but across the boundaries of these so-called traditions, because that's how the authors themselves thought. Right.
And I think, again, we have to be careful of imposing our present day understandings of religious identity anachronistically back onto pre-modern India, onto his, you know, let's say classical South Asia. And partly this is, you know, a consequence of Indian doxography or scholastic ways of arranging schools and ranking them. You know, we have these very clear systems of thought, such as the Astika and Nastika, those who adhere to the Vedas and those who don't.
Right. But even that is something that develops quite a bit later within Indian intellectual history, right?
Right. But nonetheless, it's one of the lenses through which we filter our present day understanding of those intellectual communities, those practicing communities. But I think on the ground in the early centuries of the Common Era, those identities may indeed have been much more fluid, perhaps much more transient. It may be that, for example, a philosopher who specialized in logic saw themselves first and foremost as a logician rather than a Buddhist logician or a Jain logician or somebody who adheres to the Nyaya school. So I think we do have to be careful, yes, of imposing or reading back these very strict demarcations of identity.
Mm, yeah, that's really interesting. So speaking of categories, today we often throw around, I think rather loosely, this phrase of classical yoga, which is ascribed pretty singularly to the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, perhaps with the Bhashya, the earliest commentarial layer, and perhaps together then as the Patanjala Yoga Shastra, as Philip Moss has argued. But nonetheless, this notion of classical yoga ascribed to the yoga of Patanjali. And I think there's a whole history, of why that has come to be and why Patanjali has been singled out. And perhaps the status of that text, as we know, has now been elevated to new heights as modern postural yoga has kind of taken the reins and elevated that text as sort of the scriptural foundation for postural yoga, when we know very well some of the historical complications with that, and in many ways how little the yoga of today is reflected in this early Common Era Brahminical text. Now, one of the things I really appreciate that you've done in your work, and I heard you give a conference paper on, I think, was this at the World Sanskrit Conference in Vancouver? I think is where I first heard you present this. You probably presented it earlier or elsewhere. But this notion of challenging the status of Patanjali Yoga Shastra as the exemplar of quote-unquote classical yoga. So I want to read this quote from you from your 2017 article. You talk about how our notion of classical yoga has sort of been eclipsed by the well-known definition from Yoga Sutra 1.2, Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Yoga is the cessation of mental fluctuations. This famous definition, right, that I'm sure all of our listeners are aware of and that has come to represent quote-unquote classical yoga. So you write, quote, "Yet it is time to challenge the privileged status of the Patanjali Yoga Shastra as the textual arbiter of classical yoga. Why has classical yoga not been associated with the Buddhist Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, a vast compendium on yoga practice with a final redaction in the 4th or 5th century? This omission seems remarkable given that we have more textual content for Buddhist yoga than Patanjali yoga in this period," end quote. So I really appreciate you make that really clear. You lay this out. We need to rethink this category, and we need to perhaps include texts and forms of Buddhist yoga in if we're going to maintain this category of classical yoga. So can you unpack that a little bit for us and tell us a little bit more of your thoughts behind this?
Yes. So there's quite a lot in there to unpack. I think the first point to make is that when I'm talking about the category of classical yoga, in on the whole, I'm referring to an Anglophone, modern, post-Enlightenment term, classical, which is at a certain point coupled with the term yoga to create this Anglophone category that is in circulation by scholars in, for example, religious studies, South Asian studies, philosophy. So I'm not for a moment suggesting that the Astika category and the very traditional association of the Yoga Sutra as the root text of the Yoga Darshana. So I'm not suggesting for a moment that we should in some way critique that as not accurate. I'm actually more interested in the later scholarly, in many ways, Eurocentric lenses, which pick up on, as I said, those medieval Indian doxographies and those ways of classifying yoga.
If I can just pause for a moment, just to clarify a really important point, what you just said. So you're saying that it is true that within the Indian Sanskrit traditions, these texts, these doxographies, which classify and even create hierarchies of these different darshanas, these different philosophical systems, they call the yoga darshana. That is the philosophical tradition based on the Yoga Sutra and its commentaries. So they, in that way, have a quote unquote, identification of Patanjali as the yoga tradition. But that's different than this phrase, this English phrase, classical yoga.
It is. And that's one of the problems that I'm grappling with in my book project, in my manuscript currently, is, and I'm not quite going to get into this at the moment, but, is the category of classical yoga appropriate? Is it anachronistic? Is it Eurocentric? And what other, for example, Sanskrit or South Asian language-oriented terms might we employ more fruitfully for historical accuracy?
Eclipsed, right, when we do that.
Right. I mean, if we want to talk about the term classical, it is a Eurocentric term that either refers to historical periodization or to particular aesthetic cultural values from the Greco-Roman philosophical traditions. So we have those kinds of problems, which is about categorical misfit of imposing these terms historically onto a different cultural and historical tradition. But I suppose in some senses, what I'm interested in is going beyond, in a sense, the Indian doxographies, going beyond the later Orientalist framings, both of which have their own agendas, because we have to bear in mind that by the time of the flowering of the doxographical traditions in India, Buddhism has very much diminished as a kind of significant majoritarian philosophical or religious tradition in South Asia, and it's moved on. It's moved on into China. It's moving across the Asian continent very quickly. So I think that also determines how yoga is related or not related to Buddhism in the medieval period in South Asia by Indian scholars. But I think if we excavate even further beyond these scholastic framings, what I was interested in doing, in a sense, was trying to go back to what I might call on the ground discourse and perhaps practice in the early centuries of the Common Era to see if we read the Yoga Sutra intertextually, if we read around it, can we find out more about who was practicing yoga or who was practicing traditions or that seem to be very related, perhaps in some cases identical, but which aren't called yoga? can we get a richer, fuller picture of these yoga-oriented ascetic practices in and around the Yoga Sutra at the time of the 4th century or the early 5th century? So that was my starting point and my motivation for an investigation of discourse, because I think it's very difficult to ascertain concrete details about practice in the early common era. We have so little material evidence available to us, but we can look at the discourse, which is evident in the texts and which is linked to the lived intellectual traditions and discourses of the times in which they were produced, and which can tell us something about practice.
Right. Yeah, I'm just recalling, you know, sometimes, I can't remember which scholar has made this argument, but you've heard things like that Patanjali is a quasi-Buddhist, or is a perhaps a Buddhist convert to the Brahminical tradition because of some of the language that he uses in the text. Or even, more recently, I believe Philip Moss has put forth this idea that the Patanjali Yoga Shastra in some ways is a Brahminical response to the flourishing and championing of yoga and meditation within Buddhist traditions at the same time.
Right. And I think that's a key word here, response, or I quite often use the word dialogue, because I think it's important to recall that these sutras and shastras are distillations of the living cultures of debate that were taking place in the early centuries of the Common Era, and that these debates brought together thinkers from different schools and traditions, different communities, to actively, you know, refute each other's ideas. So it was very clear that in order to engage in debate, if you were, for example, in the Sankhya camp, and if you were debating against a philosopher from Nyaya or Vaisheshika or Vedanta, you had to know their positions inside out in order to refute them. So I think this comes back to the problem of narrowing definitions of identity to just Sankhya or just yoga or just Yogacara or, you know, Sarvastivada, Vaibhashika in the Buddhist streams. Because actually, these philosophers were potentially very conversant and familiar with much more than one tradition, and potentially expert in much more than one, even if it's to be able to refute that tradition. And I think in that process of debate and dialogue, there's constant absorption of ideas, reworking of ideas as part of the skill of refutation. And this is where these processes of co-opting, transforming ideas, in order to be able to win debates, in order to be able to perform rhetorically in a debate situation. So I think I was interested in trying to find out more about this culture and community of lived debates from which the texts are then, a text like the Yoga Sutra is potentially a kind of distillation.
Yeah. And so if we are to sort of, put our scholar hats on and maybe even our Indiana Jones hat, and we are to try to travel back in time and to get on the ground during this really rich, you know, early 4th, 5th century in the Common Era, the sort of end of the Gupta period within the first millennium of India, when there really was this rich flourishing of scholastic and philosophical traditions, as well as poetics and the arts and logic. And as we try to expand our vision of yoga beyond and alongside Patanjali and what we might call the Brahminical yoga tradition, as you write, we have actually more textual content for a Buddhist yoga during this period than Patanjali yoga. So what was going on the Buddhist side during this period? And what were some of the texts that you found and that you continue to find are really important and significant to read alongside Patanjali?
As I mentioned, I began by looking at the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya. So Kosha means treasury. So this text is the treasury of Abhidharma, which is one of the mainstream Buddhist schools that is generally characterized as scholastic and developed very complex ways of classifying being and reality. I was looking at this text by Vasubandhu, which is in itself a voluminous treatise. It's the verses which summarize the orthodox Sarvastivada Abhidharma tradition and an auto-commentary, meaning that the author Vasubandhu wrote the verses and then wrote the commentary which discusses and expands on those verses. And by looking at this text, I realized that it has an intertextual relationship with another text, another great treatise called the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra. So this is the Shastra or the treatise which contains the bhumis or the foundations of Yogacara. And at this point, I became interested.
That interesting.
Right. So within the last couple of decades, I think the discussion on what Yogacara means was in some ways very much determined by some influential articles by Jonathan Silk, where he argues that it's such a, you know, widely used and varying term that we can't really pin it down to a specific meaning, but that we should regard it as having a quite generic meaning, such as spiritual practitioner within Buddhism. But in recent years, we've had some variant studies coming out, people like Daniel Stewart or Florent Delanue, who have looked at the term more technically within specific texts of the early Yogacara tradition. And we start to see this argument developing that actually it is possible and desirable to think about Yogacara as meaning something like yoga discipline, which is how I translate it, or yoga practice. And so I became interested in the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra as a shastra on the discipline of yoga within Buddhism. Now, I think there's a couple of points to make here about the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, which is that it's one of those texts that hasn't been incredibly well preserved in Sanskrit. So again, there has been more scholarship in on the Tibetan and Chinese editions of this text. It's a very long text, which is actually not really a singular composition, but comprising a whole range of books that are brought together into one unitary composition over a long period of time, possibly centuries. So the earliest layers, which would be a book that's called the Shravaka Bhumi and another book that's called the Bodhisattva Bhumi, date back probably to the second, third centuries of the Common Era in their proto forms or their, you know, their very early forms. It's not an easy, you know, you can't just pick it up and find it in English translation. Even the work of translating it into English and creating critical editions is still very much in process.
Are the earliest manuscripts that we have of those bhumis, are they in Chinese?
They are, yeah. They are preserved in Chinese, the very earliest proto layers, and then they show up again in Sanskrit a couple of centuries later in the, you know, the final redaction of the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra. So it's a complex, it's a complex text. And I think this goes back to your question of why, in a sense, why haven't we been looking at Yogacara? Well, perhaps in terms of translations and critical editions, and the ways in which scholars train, typically who are in yoga studies, perhaps this is the moment when we start to have the text available to us in a more accessible way.
Right. Yeah. Very, very complicated textual history and transmission, written in Sanskrit and then transmitted probably across the Silk Route to China, to Chinese, and then back to Sanskrit, and then probably eventually into Tibetan. Is that right?
That is right. Yes. So when it's transmitted into China, I'm not sure that it necessarily comes back into Sanskrit, but I suppose it shows up in Sanskrit, so that it may have been extant, influential, circulating, the Shravaka Bhumi, for example, in South Asia, but it just hasn't survived. So that whole very early part of the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra is, like many of the key Indian philosophical texts, somewhat still somewhat inaccessible to us. So when I started looking at Yogacara, the other key question that I was interested in was an emerging strand of scholarship in Buddhist studies, which was positioning a slightly different Yogacara community to the one that might be better known in the main in Buddhist studies. So in Buddhist studies, Yogacara is obviously one of the main streams of Mahayana Buddhism, along with the Madhyamaka tradition and the Prajnaparamita traditions. But Yogacara is typically seen as a school of philosophy that in some sense crystallizes around the 5th century. And again, scholars like Florent Delanoux and Daniel Stewart were interested in an earlier community of Yogacaras who were in some sense not these philosophers, but early ascetic practitioners of meditation and retreat, and who had somewhat of a special status within Buddhist monastic communities. So I became interested in the fact that we have these early, in some senses, they're referred to as forest ascetics, who are engaged in the discipline of yoga within Buddhism, who in some senses are connected back to Vasubandhu's text through a dissident community called the Sautrantikas. So without wishing to go into too much technical detail, because I know we don't have all of these Sanskrit terms displayed in front of us to look at, but it became clear that there's a very complex web of communities that are sharing ideas in the first, second, third century of the Common Era, and who are, in some senses, claiming this title of yoga through this term, Yogacara, discipline of yoga.
Now, you know, in Patanjali, we get this definition of yoga, as we spoke about 1.2, you know, yoga is the citta vritti nirodha, the cessation of the turnings of the mind. And in the Bhashya, in the commentary, we learn that this is equated with a state of samadhi. Do we have any clear definitions of yoga like that in these Yogacara texts? We have, as we've discussed, this term Yogacara, which, as you said, can kind of loosely mean spiritual practice or the practice of yoga. But what is yoga in the Yogacara context, and what can we say about how this relates or differentiates from the yoga of Patanjali?
That's a really interesting question, because across the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra and also in other early Mahayana sutras, we do find varying definitions of yoga and yogacara. So for example, if we go back to the Shravaka Bhumi, which is one of the early layers of the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, we come across a definition of yoga as consisting of four elements, which are faith, shraddha, aspiration, chandas, vigor, or courage, virya, and fourthly, means, upaya. So my question was, what are the processes of, first and foremost, canonization? Why is it that the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, which deals with the discipline of yoga, isn't part of the so-called classical canon? It is a shastra on yoga or yogacara. And how is it that certain definitions become, as you say, elevated or prioritized, or in a sense canonized, so that Patanjali's definition is quintessential, but this fourfold definition, yoga is faith, aspiration, courage, and means, that this is probably fairly unknown to the majority of yoga studies scholars who are working within the Brahminical domain, working with the Brahminical texts. And there are many other examples of different ways in which yoga is explained or systematized within the Buddhist Yogacara texts within the early Mahayana tradition. So I became very interested in this. First of all, as we say, what is on the ground? And what happens if we ask those very rebellious questions? Because I think that's an important part of scholarship, is to, when you're starting out on a new research project, to investigate what are my assumptions. If I assume that yoga is exclusively part of the Brahmanical tradition, well, what happens if I ask the question, but what if it was the Buddhists who were the predominant practitioners and ideologists and, intellectual debaters of the yoga tradition in the early common era? What if history has in some way filtered out the fact that that Buddhist discourse, which is there in the text, is perhaps pointing to a more substantial or more significant living tradition, practice tradition that we perhaps have yet to really understand.
And this definition of these four elements, faith, aspiration, vigor, and means, that's a really interesting definition of yoga. And it reads as a list of cultivation practices or even qualities, rather than yoga as a state or a goal. This usage of yoga really does seem to refer to a set of ethical and meditative practices. Would you agree with that?
Very much so. So in a sense, there isn't really a distinction here between what we would now call meditation and yoga. Or indeed between ethical practice or an ethical identity and meditation, because they're very much bound up with each other. They're very much one and the same. To meditate is to be ethical, is to be practicing the discipline of yoga.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Certainly within the Buddhist tradition, I should frame that as within the early, Buddhist tradition of the early common era.
So I want to get into some examples a little bit from the Yoga Sutra and then from this Buddhist literature that you've highlighted in your work that I think really illuminates how reading across these texts and traditions can really help us to understand a text like the Yoga Sutra perhaps more fully, and to understand how perhaps its author, Patanjali, may have been thinking and you know, how he might have been using very technical terminology. And in certain cases, I think, as you and others show, maybe, you know, reformulating or readapting key terms. So you have this wonderful article from 2017, published in the Religions of South Asia. The article is titled Classical Discourses of Liberation, Shared Botanical Metaphors in Sarvastivada Buddhism and the Yoga of Patanjali. And I love this idea, I have to say, of shared botanical metaphors, because even before I've seen your work and heard you present on this, it's actually something that occurred to me. I actually can't take full credit for it. It was during a seminar, a grad seminar at Harvard, which I was the teaching assistant for, with Professor Francis Clooney. And we were just doing a close reading of the Yoga Sutra and its bhashya and commentary. And one thing that became really, really clear just on the yoga side, on the Patanjali side, is that there's a lot of imagery and metaphor, what we kind of refer to as agricultural terms, referring to, as you point out as well, seeds and the burning of seeds. There's even the mind or citta. There's this image of the mind as like a river and all of the currents, the citta vrittis flowing that need to be dammed. And it was really quite interesting just to sort of detect that in the text. And then in this article, I think what you do so well is to show that in some ways Patanjali is leaning on or drawing on a wider discursive network of using some of these botanical metaphors. So tell us a little bit about that. Maybe in particular, we can look at this idea of the kleshas and this model of the kleshas or the mental afflictions, using metaphors of botany.
Right. Lots of interesting ideas in there to respond to. In terms of the shared botanical metaphors, I mean, we find these in the Yoga Sutra, in Buddhist texts, also in Jain texts, and arguably into all genres of literature and cultural output. And I think in some sense, this is inevitable if we think about the way that concepts are formed. And I'm drawing here a little bit on conceptual metaphor theory, but concepts in a way have to draw on the experiential knowledge that we have of the world. And conceptual metaphor theory would say that every concept is in some way drawing on our experience of the world and our embodied experience of the world. So all of these systems of liberation that we see in the Brahmanical tradition, in Buddhism, you know, systems of becoming liberated, complex pathways of practice. I think that they're all constructed from the material world that these thinkers and practitioners and philosophers dwelt in. Mm. And so that in that sense, we're talking about a largely agricultural world, an experience of the world that's very much informed by existential needs, food production, weather patterns, for example. These would have been very prevalent in the experience and worldview of our actors in the second, third century. So in some sense, I think that real world experience is showing up in the texts, all of the texts and all of the cultural artifacts, from poetry to plays, etc.
Karen, are you saying that Patanjali might have also been a gardener or a farmer?
Not necessarily, but I think that the existential reality of adulthood and survival in the early common era is, you know, it would have been much more acutely tuned into the natural world and food cycles and weather patterns, much more than it is for us now in our contemporary world. So I think that these systems of liberation are in some sense, as I point out, drawing on, you know, botanical cycles of the seed and the plant growth and the fruition and how to weed out the bad plants and, you know, the kind of necessity of rain as a great boon, but also, you know, existentially necessary. I think that all of these material conditions of survival in a way inform the way that theories of liberation develop and therefore inform the way that paths of practice and meditation and bodily practices, the way that they're constructed systematically. So I suppose to sum up that point, I think, you know, seeing all of these botanical metaphors show up in the text is part and parcel of the lived reality of that time. But then your other point about certain particular metaphors showing up in very technical ways, I think is interesting. And this is the point that I've tried to lay out in that 2017 article. I became interested in the kleshas, which interestingly, if you are in Hindu studies or yoga studies, you probably refer to the kleshas, you translate them as the afflictions. Mm-hmm. But if you're working in Buddhist studies, more often they will be the defilements. Mm. The kleshas are the defilements. So this is just a convention, a translational convention in
and
the...
What is significant about that difference, even in the English terms, but within those different contexts? Affliction versus defilement.
Well, I mean, you could argue, if we're looking at the metaphorical significance of each, you could argue that affliction in some way is drawing on the domain of medical discourse, the idea that there's a pain or an illness that can be in some sense remedied or countered with a medicine, whereas defilement is part of a different conceptual domain, which perhaps, I don't know, perhaps is more attuned to ritual practice or other social practices, which is to do with purity and impurity. Mm. Or perhaps, who knows, alchemy, you know, to do with purity and impurity of particular substances that are being transformed.
Mm. Your point is really good, though, and notable in that, you know, not only do we have variability in how some of these technical Sanskrit terms are translated, but if you're trained within a particular discipline and if you kind of work on Hindu studies and more on the Brahminical text, you might just naturally translate a term in a particular way based on the history of scholarship on that subject, which then if you're working in kind of a different disciplinary camp, say on Buddhist studies, there might be a different sentiment to the same term, whether or not it's actually the same, whether or not the meaning of the Sanskrit term is the same or not. But it's just interesting to reflect on our definitions, our translations of these Sanskrit terms, and how those often are shaped by our Sanskrit English dictionaries, by the history of scholarship on that subject. And I think one thing that you do actually really well in this article is you complicate some of those terms a little bit, and again show how when reading across the Brahminical and the Buddhist textual lines, we can perhaps get a fuller picture of some of these terms. And I think that's really important. I think I cut you off though.
You didn't.
Get into the Klesha model here that you're working on here in this article.
Right. So I don't think you cut me off at all, but to continue that thread, I did become very interested in this term Klesha because I hadn't in my readings of the relevant Brahmanical literature such as the Gita, the Upanishads, the Shantiparvan and the Mahabharata, I hadn't been particularly struck by elaborate discussions of the kleshas, the afflictions. So I was interested in looking into this more. Of course, the kleshas are mentioned in the Brahmanical sources, but not to the extent that they are systematically elaborated in the Buddhist sources. So the in some texts you will see that in some ways the very goal of Buddhist practice is the eradication of the kleshas. And eradicating the kleshas is in some technical definitions equated with the state of liberation itself. Mm-hmm. And there are very, as I mentioned, systematic, detailed analyses of what the kleshas are, what different types of technical practices you do to remove particular kleshas, what the process is of removing these kleshas, how specific kleshas can be treated in meditation. So there's a very extensive discourse on kleshas in these meditation manuals that we find not only in Yogacara, but also in the scholastic Abhidharma tradition. And then I was able to, in many ways, build on the work of preceding scholars all the way from, the 19th century Indian and Orientalist scholars all the way up to Philip Maas's work in 2013, mm-hmm. and to find some new instances of intertextual mirroring, I don't want to call it borrowing, but in a sense mirroring between Vasubandhu's text, which is the Abhidharma Kosha-Bhashya, and Patanjali's text. And so that 2017 article discusses, I think, two or three different passages, one of which is a very close, almost word for word, technical reuse between Vasubandhu's and Patanjali's texts, and the others are slightly more loose intertextual passages in terms of the relationship. But it was interesting because, depending on how we date the Patanjali Yoga Shastra and the Vasubandhu's text, it might be possible to assert that Patanjali is borrowing in some sense from the discourse that we see in the Abhidharma Kosha-Bhashya. But the Abhidharma Kosha-Bhashya itself, in some sense, represents two different debates or discursive positions within the text. So the verses present the orthodox Sarvastivada Abhidharma view. And then in the commentary, we have a dissident group called the Sautrantikas. There's not a lot known about them, but they're very interesting, and they do hold this dissident position where they reject a lot of the orthodox truths or positions in Abhidharma. So what I was trying to trace in the article was the fact that when Patanjali seems to be referring to the ideas in Vasubandhu's text, he's not referring to the orthodox positions, but what he seems to be reproducing, if we can say that, mm-hmm. In terms of the theory of the kleshas, and how they evolve, how they get destroyed, he seems to be referring to this dissident position held by the group called the Sautrantikas. Mm-hmm. And they develop quite a distinct theory of how you get rid of the afflictions in the mind. There are particular techniques which are described using metaphors that are drawing on the botanical realm, drawing on agriculture. So you have to take the seed and you have to burn it, which destroys its germination potential, meaning that it can't self-seed in the substratum of the mind, and so forth. There are these very specific technical terms that are used in the Yoga Sutra that we typically only find in the Sautrantika positions in the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya.
Yeah, there's this constant metaphor, this phrase, I think mostly in the Bhashya of the Yoga Sutra, the Dugdha Bija, the burnt seed. And so would you suggest this is not original to the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, this notion of the klesha as likened to a seed, this affliction or defilement of the mind, like ignorance, you know, depending on how we translate these, attraction, aversion, and so forth, these kleshas that need to somehow be scorched or burnt like a seed. Is that something that is shared with this Abhidharma literature?
It is shared actually more broadly as a metaphor, but the precise wording that we see in the Yoga Sutra in terms of the passage in the commentary, that very close intertextual correspondence is with, in particular, this passage in the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya.
I mean, for both traditions, it's really like the key thing that has to be removed for liberation to occur. For Patanjali, you know, he says that in 2.1, you know, this Kriya Yoga, and 2.2, Kriya Yoga is for the cultivation of samadhi and for the weakening of the kleshas. And then when we get to Ashtanga Yoga a little bit later, it doesn't use the word klesha, but rather ashuddhi, I believe, impurities. But Ashtanga Yoga is for the removal of impurities. So for Patanjali, it's quite clear that like the purpose of a yoga practice, on the one hand, is for the purification or removal of these sort of mental obstacles or afflictions, things that keep one from perceiving reality clearly, we might even say, for a Sankhya Yoga perspective, one that keeps one bound to Prakriti. And so the kleshas are really, really important within this model of liberation. And the practice of yoga, it seems for Patanjali, in many ways, we could say, is actually to purify and remove the kleshas. Is that similar for Vasubandhu?
It is very much the same theory that we find in Vasubandhu and that we find discussed by this dissident group called the Sautrantikas, because they are really concerned with the fact that the kleshas are so dangerous because they have this state which is dormancy, that they are lying undetected in the substratum of the mind in this dormant state, and that they're therefore difficult to remove because of that state in which they have potential, but they're not yet actuated. They're not yet being, you know, awakened and expressed.
Mm-hmm. And that sounds very, very similar to the Patanjali model, and this notion of the depository, right, or ashaya, that like the samskaras and vasanas, these remainders or traces, you know, these difficult words to translate, but that there's this potentiated state, to use the metaphor of a seed, like you could eliminate some of the seeds, you could even burn it, right, but maybe not burn it completely, and that there's still the potential for that seed to germinate if the causes and conditions come together for that seed to germinate. So there's levels of the extermination, right, of the seed of klesha.
Exactly. And I see, you know, we see this mirroring between the commentary to Yoga Sutra 2.4, which is asking these questions about the different modes of existence or the different states in which a klesha can exist, and which is asking the question, what is the dormant state? Mm. And what is it that causes a dormant klesha to awake? And this is very resonant of a passage in the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya 5.1, which asks the same questions in the same order about dormancy and awakening. And I think it's this kind of, if you like, anxiety about the klesha, which is exactly showing up in those metaphorical descriptions of not just burning the seed, but scorching it to the degree that the germination potential will not again be reactivated or will not again reawaken. So it's this very technical, botanically derived understanding of how the mind operates and how habits, negative habits, are created and perpetuated in the mind, which are the focus of meditation practice. That is what the meditation practice is designed to eliminate.
Yeah, and you make this important point in the 2017 article that there are some scholars, I believe Endo previously, who have looked at this klesha and this burning of the klesha model from a tapas standpoint, from kind of the broader Brahminical notions of an ascetic cultivating this inner heat that can burn through and purify the impurities or afflictions like kleshas. And while that might make sense to some degree, and within like a Kriya Yoga context of tapas being one of those three ingredients of Kriya Yoga to eliminate the kleshas, it perhaps doesn't capture the full picture, because, as you said, there's these imprints and these attenuated and dormant states that still need to be addressed. And that it seems like the Buddhist context helps us to fill out more clearly when we look not only at this from a tapas angle, but from a broader soteriology of removing the impediments of ignorance, of avidya, to use Patanjali's term, that it's not simply the purification, say, of karmic activity, but there's actually something more gnosiological or some sort of shift that seems to then take place, eliminating an incorrect perception. There's some sort of positive pull of this, right? Where there's actually a wisdom or a jnana that arises through this process. I'm kind of generalizing a bit now, but do you think, is that something that is important on the Buddhist side, that it's not simply the elimination or burning of the negative obstacles, but there's also the cultivation and there's the growth of a type of liberating knowledge or wisdom?
Absolutely. And depending on which school and which tradition we're looking at, the klesha, you know, the elimination of the kleshas may then be followed by different more advanced states and or practices to lead to full liberation. But I think it's fair to say that in the Buddhist meditative tradition, the elimination of the kleshas is a quintessential feature of all of those different meditation models.
Yeah. And so speaking about kind of liberating states and reading across these traditions, you have a recent article published in 2020 by the Journal of Indian Philosophy entitled Dharma Mega in Yoga and Yogacara, the Revision of a Superlative Metaphor. And without going through the entire article or every move of this really important contribution, I would love to ask you a little bit about this, because it's one of these terms, phrases in the Yoga Sutra that comes really at the end of the text in the fourth pada. Really, and at the very end, after we've already gone through all of these different levels of samadhi, of cognitive samadhi with an object, sampragnata samadhi, asampragnata samadhi, and even various stages in between, all of a sudden, and almost out of nowhere, Patanjali seems to introduce this new term, and which seems to be this really, really exalted high state of meditative absorption, which he terms, or the term he uses, is Dharma Mega. And as you know, and as your article lays out, there's been a real history of interpretation of this term, which can translate, I mean, literally as the cloud or the rain cloud of Dharma. And so there's been a lot of different interpretations of, you know, what does the word Dharma mean here? What is the rain cloud of Dharma? What type of samadhi is this? I think there's differing opinions both within the Sanskrit commentarial tradition and then also among more modern scholars and translators who have tried to make sense of this. And I think what, again, you do so well is helping us to locate a word, a really technical term like this, by looking also at the broader Buddhist context. So, and especially, you know, with a term like Dharma, which holds and carries so much weight in these Buddhist contexts as well. So, somewhat briefly, you know, without going into, again, every single step of the way of this article, but what can you tell us about what you've found about this term Dharma Mega Samadhi, and how do you think Patanjali is using it here in the sutras? For anybody who wants to look it up, this is in 4.29.
So I think Dharma Mega is another of those very technical terms, in the same way that we've been discussing Klesha as part of this technical vocabulary of terms like Bhagdabija, the scorched seed. So Dharma Mega, the cloud of Dharma, is also discussed in the commentary to Sutra 1.2, if you read the sutra and the commentary, the Bhashya together as a whole. So arguably, it's not just introduced at the very end, if we read the Patanjali Yoga Shastra as a unitary composition, but it's also used to frame the path of practice or the path of practice and philosophy, I should say, from the very beginning of the text. And in many ways, I had the same question, which led me on an intertextual journey. What is the term Dharma Mega? If it's so important, why do we seem to have so little explanation of its function, its significance in Patanjali's text? And again, I went back to the Vedic text, to the Upanishads, to the Mahabharata, to the Gita, but it was really in the early Mahayana sutras that I found Dharma Mega elaborated as a soteriological concept, or the zenith of a system of liberation. And there it has this very common meaning or frequently recurring meaning of referring to this rain cloud which pours down abundant waters onto the earth and brings about cultivation of the good. So we've been talking about klesha as elimination of the negative, and Dharma Mega is in a way a conceptual counterpart to that. It's the abundant sharing of the teachings from the Buddha or the Bodhisattva, depending on which tradition of Buddhism we're reading. Because the term is there also in a more nascent form in the canonical Buddhist scripture, but most definitely elaborated distinctly in early Mahayana. And those descriptions in the Mahayana sutras are really evocative. They're very, very much imbued with this notion of fecundity and fertility, and they're often very detailed in the way that we find in those Mahayana sutras. And I was struck by the distinctness and the difference of Patanjali's use of the term Dharmamega in relation to these Buddhist sources, where it is it's used very minimally, very sparingly, as we would expect really of any metaphor in the sutra style. Right. Sutras tend not to elaborate in the same way as the Buddhist Mahayana sutras do. But even conceptually, because Dharmamega in the Sankhya system is referring to a state of isolation, whereby the goal is for Purusha, the principle of pure consciousness, to be realized as distinct, separate from Prakriti, the principle of pure materiality. My understanding of Dharmamega in the Patanjali Yoga Shastra is that it does indicate something quite opposite to the Buddhist meaning of fullness and abundance. It indicates this technical notion of lack, of isolation, which is the ideal state of liberation in the Yoga Sutra and its Bhashya. So then the question becomes, well, if we accept that it's different, perhaps even seems to have some kind of opposite meaning to that of the much more prevalent Buddhist use, then why is it different? Is it that Patanjali is co-opting this term from the Buddhist religious sphere and imbuing it with a distinct Sankhya meaning? Is this in a way the kind of polemical encounter that we see in debate where terms are taken and revised? So that was the question that I was exploring in that article, coming to the conclusion that because we see Dharmamega in the Lotus Sutra, in the Dashabhumika Sutra, in the Sandinamochana Sutra, in all of these different Buddhist texts, my assumption is that the prevalent meaning of it was being determined and discussed by the Buddhists, and that Patanjali is in some sense responding to that or co-opting the term for the Sankhya system, for his text.
Yeah, that is quite interesting then. If it clearly in the Buddhist context means this sort of rain cloud of the Buddha Dharma, of the teachings of the Buddha, that sort of rain down, and again, in kind of an agricultural metaphor, these teachings, that the coolness of the rain of the Dharma that sort of rains down and nourishes and eliminates the obstacles or the suffering of the bodhisattvas, of the practitioner. You have that kind of an imagery, and if that's invoked by this term, it really does all of a sudden seem out of place in the Yoga Sutra, where I don't think Patanjali would say, okay, now you're at this very end, you've renounced, you're no longer interested in this thing called prasankhyana, which we won't get too into right now, but this really high state of concentration or meditative absorption. And then through one's discriminative discernment or vivekakhyati, then this samadhi called Dharmamega arises. I don't think he's saying then the Buddhist teachings then rain down.
No.
That would be very odd. So yeah, perhaps
no.
Borrowing, but then reframing the term. But it is really curious, even in the Bhashya, it doesn't really explain what that means. It does say, though, then, of course, the next sutra, Tataha Klesha karma nivrittihi, then we have this total cessation of the kleshas and the karmas. So it is obviously this really important liberative moment where, because of this dharma meka samadhi, there then is the cessation of the kleshas. It's always puzzled me as just this sort of interesting problem. And so what is sort of your main takeaway of having kind of looked at this broadly? If this is a brahminical reuse or readaptation of it, what do we think that Patanjali means by it?
I think it means exactly as you've so eloquently put. It just means cessation. It means the state of cessation that arises when we apply discriminating discernment correctly. And the state of cessation is what produces the isolation of consciousness from materiality. And this is liberation. So I think it's very clear that dharma mega here is most definitely not being used to indicate the Buddhist dharma, but simply has the symbolic value of dharma mega in Buddhist liberation, which means it's the apex of attainment. Mm. So it's just taking the highest value from those contemporaneous Mahayana systems and perhaps saying, well, we have our dharma mega here in this corner, and this is what it is. It's isolation of consciousness from materiality. So I think what if Patanjali is in some sense co-opting the term, technically he is divesting it of that Buddhist meaning and assigning it with a different meaning or a different value in terms of what it means as the liberated state.
Right. And of course, Buddhists don't have ownership over the term dharma. Of course, it has a rich legacy and history in the Brahminical tradition, and it carries different meaning. That's a really interesting example of why reading across these texts and traditions is so important, to be able to locate a broader textual field and context for a history of a really technical and precise term like that. So just to kind of move things forward a little bit, Karen, as I think we're starting to wind down a little bit, another thing I really want to talk to you about that moves us beyond this particular conversation is one of the projects that you've been also working on is co-editing this new volume, The Rutledge Handbook of Yoga and Meditation Studies. And I think there's something like over 30 chapters in this new book. I remember seeing a snapshot of a table of contents, and it looks like a really important contribution to perhaps nudge the field forward. I know you're co-editing this volume with Suzanne Newcomb. Can you tell us a little bit about this exciting new edited volume and when this book will be coming out?
Yes, well, the Routledge Handbook of Yoga and Meditation Studies is scheduled to be out at the end of October 2020. Mm. It's designed as, first and foremost, a graduate student handbook, but is also accessible for undergraduates and indeed for any interested student of yoga and meditation studies. And it is 34 chapters which seek to bring together scholarship on yoga and meditation, academic yoga studies and meditation studies, and to also bring the reader up to date on some of the emerging areas of scholarship, some of the new approaches, multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, some of the new scholarship on different regions, which is being published in English for the first time. Mm. So for example, we have a key summary on the history of yoga in Latin America by Adrian Munoz. We have Hidehiko Kurita has authored a chapter on the political history of meditation, yoga and meditation in Japan. We have an overview of the recent history of yoga and meditation in Korea, for example. So these are, you know, some of the chapters that bring new regional summaries published in English for the first time. We have new multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary studies, such as Finian Geraghty's chapter. I know you had Finn on the podcast recently. So he's utilizing sound studies in his investigation of the history of Aum within the practice of yoga. Or we have, for example, Gudrun Buneman, who's looking at meditation within an art history context and a material culture context. So it's a really exciting scholarly resource that I think provides very accessible roundups of where research is, and also some very new particular additions and emerging foci within the combined fields of yoga and meditation studies.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm really excited to read it. It's really is an impressive volume when we look across the various fields and disciplines that are represented in it. And then as you were saying, these different geographies and regions as well that have often been underrepresented until now. So I think it's an exciting contribution to the growing field of yoga studies, and sounds like it's going to help move us forward in a lot of exciting new directions. So
I hope so. And in terms of, I think you introduced the book with this phrase, reframing the field, or perhaps I use that phrase. But the first part does contain some very interesting theoretical reflections on what's happening within the field. So we have, for example, a chapter by Shamim Black, which looks at decolonizing yoga. We have a chapter by Andrea Jane on neoliberal yoga. Mark Singleton and Borean Larios have co-authored a chapter looking at the scholar-practitioner identity within the Western Academy. And, you know, it's 34 chapters, so I really have to stop myself now, or I would be here for a long time. But it is a scholarly resource, so initially it may be priced primarily for libraries, but our hope is that there will be you know, a more affordable version coming out in the future.
That would be great. Well, I think you've also given me a list of 34 new podcast episodes and scholars to interview as well. So
I hope so. That would be great.
Yeah, that would keep me occupied and busy for quite a while. Before I let you go, I do have to ask you about your upcoming course for yogic studies on classical yoga and Buddhism. This course, which is going to run July 13th through August 7th. So I guess depending on when folks are listening to this, might be very soon. Enrollment will be opening for this very soon. And tell us just a little bit about what students can expect in this four-week online course.
Well, first, thank you very much for inviting me to teach. I'm very excited about this course, which is going to be four classes, looking at this relationship between classical yoga and Buddhism, and breaking down some of the ideas that I've been talking about today and examining in my recent research. So the first session will take us through with close reading of the words, the terms, the paradigms, the frameworks, the practices, which have been identified as quote unquote Buddhist by scholars from different time periods. And I use those quotation marks because, as you have rightly pointed out, we have to be careful of making the claim that any particular word is Buddhist or Hindu or Jain, for example. But there are certainly practices and discourses that we can identify as belonging to certain traditions. Then in the second and third sessions, we're going to break down in a very accessible way what we mean by Yogacara. Who were the Yogacaras? What did they practice? How were they viewed? And we're going to look again with slow, detailed readings at some of the passages that I've alluded to today, which discuss yoga in these different Yogacara texts in the Mahayana Sutras. And we'll do the same for session three with Patanjali Yoga and Abhidharma. We'll think about some of those key ideas about meditation and the mind that we find in Abhidharma, and examine passages that reflect or share these ideas in the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. And then in the fourth session, we will look at the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra as our potential other shastra of the classical era. And we will think about some of the echoes that are apparent in the modes of practice between the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra and Patanjali's text.
Fantastic. Well, I'm excited. I can't wait to take the course myself. I know that I will learn a lot. I remember actually my second term of studying Sanskrit, we read a little bit of the Abhidharma Kosha Karika with Professor Colette Cox from the University of Washington. I was definitely way over my head with only it being my second term of Sanskrit. But it's always a text I wanted to return to later because I already saw its importance and parallels for all of these reasons we've been talking about today. So I'm personally excited to have an opportunity to dive into this comparative textual study a bit further with you, and excited to share that with the broader community and anybody who's interested in exploring these topics and kind of carving out the time to actually get to sit down and really closely read these texts and these passages side by side, and to think across, you know, Hindu and Buddhist yoga traditions. So thank you so much, Karen, you know, for offering the course and for your time today, for sharing with us your fascinating and important research on all of these topics. And yeah, just a big thanks.
Thank you very much for having me, and I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, you bet. Of course, we'll be in touch soon about the course. And I think that's all for now. So take care, Karen. I hope it cools down for you there in London.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.